fourth case, United States versus Gregory Blaylock, 13-1539. Mr. King.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Scott King. I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Gregory Blaylock. Mr. Blaylock is appealing the denial of a motion to suppress. That right of appeal was reserved in a conditional plea agreement filed and accepted by District Judge Castillo. The issue presented is whether or not, under the facts of this case, the arrest, what we contend was an arrest, of Mr. Blaylock and the subsequent obtaining of the key incriminating evidence against him was or was not in violation of his rights under the Fourth Amendment. This case began with a report regarding drug activity and the East 50th Place condo building in the Hyde Park neighborhood of the city. That information was not directed at Mr. Blaylock, rather a couple of brothers, last name of Smith. March 14, 2011, in response to that, law enforcement agents set up some surveillance and make certain observations regarding, in particular, a van, which they identify with one of the Smith brothers. 2 days later, they return. They see the van, and then they see another vehicle. The two vehicles come into the parking lot, where tenants and presumably guests are permitted to park. They do not observe, based on the record in this case, any interaction between Mr. Blaylock and the second vehicle and these individuals. What they observe is Mr. Blaylock get out of the, I think it's a GMC Sierra, look in the direction of what the surveillance vehicle was, and in the description in one or more of the reports submitted as part of the record, appeared to look inside the vehicle.
Well, Mr. King, even before that, though, didn't they see Mr. Blaylock's vehicle kind of circle the lot or sort of take a pass?
I'm not sure if that preceded or came after, but that event did occur. They then...
Well, that sounds like what I've heard called counter-surveillance.
Well, I know the government's characterizing it, and it could also be a paying tenant for a condominium with reserved parking wondering who might be in this space, or might wonder, why is this person in my neighbor's space? I don't recognize the vehicle. There's all sorts of innocent explanations, which are, according to the decision cited by both parties in this case, in our briefs, that consideration of some of the innocent explanations, this is in Funches, cited by both of us, Judge Keeney's opinion, is helpful in making this evaluation. In any event, what ends up transpiring, Mr. Blaylock comes back out into a different vehicle, ultimately determined to be driven by a Marcel Cook. He gets in it in the rear of the building. The car goes around to the front of the building. Mr. Blaylock is seen leaving the vehicle, and in leaving, he is observed by agents in his right hand to have a cell phone, to be engaged in conversation apparently, and in his left hand to have a paper lunch-sized bag. He enters the front entrance to the condo the building. Immediately thereafter, agents, law enforcement, comes in the rear entrance. Mr. Blaylock is seen standing in immediate proximity to the elevator, and I believe in the record some photographs were submitted for Judge Castillo's consideration in our part of the record here. According to agents, as they come in, wearing regalia, clearly identifying them as some form of law enforcement, they quote-unquote see him run, apparently to get into the elevator. He gets in the elevator. They get him in the elevator. His hand is under his waist of his jacket. They immediately, at gunpoint, order him to the floor, handcuff him, search his person. They obtain keys. They obtain wallet and identification, which yields then, after conversation with management, identification to a particular condominium in the name of who's been identified as his girlfriend. She's contacted, comes down, executes, after some dialogue with the agents, executes a consent to search, and drugs, paraphernalia, packaging materials, and a gun are all recovered inside the condominium. It's our contention that, first of all, the alternative position by both the district judge and by the government, that the initial action, the initial confrontation between law enforcement and Mr. Blalock was nothing more than a Terry stop. We respectfully suggest this record does not support that contention. This is hardly anything short of an actual physical arrest. The test is...
Well, in order to effectuate a Terry stop and to eliminate the suspicion that underlies a Terry stop, it's permissible to handcuff the suspect, isn't it? I mean, permissible.
It's a sliding scale based on what's presented to a reasonable law enforcement officer. What is happening, and what's the circumstance of the officer? I mean, I hearken back to the fact...
So when he sees the clearly identified police officers, he starts to run and tries to get away, so they force him to the ground and handcuff him. What's unreasonable about that?
Is there's no probable cause, and what you have done is arrested him.
Even with Terry's suspicion, though, if you want to dissipate that suspicion, you've got to get a hold of the guy and figure out what's going on there.
Police officer, law enforcement makes a career of wanting to dissipate suspicion.
Right. But
the Fourth Amendment stands in the way of being able to do it at certain costs to the privacy rights and the reasonable expectation of privacy of its citizens. And under these facts, while they had every right in the world to certainly engage in conversation, to certainly even physically touch him, if they had concern, for example, of the hand under the waist of the jacket, to disable that arm or hand to be able,
but they cannot cuff him, they cannot force him to the ground.
I do not believe in these facts they can do so without A, it constituting an arrest and therefore requiring probable cause as opposed to reasonable suspicion. And I believe the facts of this case do not warrant a finding that there was probable cause. And I'd like to reserve the balance, if the court please, of my time for a rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Marin, if I'm not pronouncing that right, please correct me.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Maureen Marin, and I represent the United States. The district court did not err when it denied defendants' motion to suppress. Considering the totality of the circumstances, the activities observed by the agents while they were surveilling this building in Hyde Park, in their training and experience, suggested a narcotics transaction. That was only reinforced when the defendant fled upon seeing ATF agents. When the defendant fled into the elevator, the defendant had his hand underneath his jacket pocket. The agents ordered him to show his hands, and he refused. It's at that point that the officers drew a firearm on the defendant and ordered him to the floor. When he got down on the floor, he dropped what he was holding in his hand, which turned out to be a paper bag. The agents then examined the paper bag to determine whether or not there was a weapon in the bag. They did not find a weapon. They did find $7,000 in cash. Further adding to the probable cause for defendant's arrest at that point for engaging...
What was the address of the arrest?
I'm sorry?
The address where the arrest occurred.
It was an apartment on East 50th Place in Hyde Park. So the defendant, I don't remember the exact building
That's
number.
That's okay. I can visualize it. I was born in the Langen Hospital in Chicago.
It's not very far from Lakeshore Drive in the complex of apartments right there. The defendant, what the officers encountered when they began
I was determining whether or not $7,000 was a lot for walking around money in that area.
The defendant's possession of $7,000 was complicated by the fact that officers simultaneously had stopped his co-defendant and recovered a significant number of ounces of crack cocaine. That being said, what the officers knew at the time was that they had a building where they had received reports of drug dealing activity taking place. They had observed the defendant enter the building in a manner that suggested counter-surveillance. And then they had observed the defendant personally involved in a transaction that suggested a narcotics transaction, where a car pulled up, the defendant exited, concealing an item under his jacket, entered the car, they took a trip halfway around the block, the defendant exited, the car pulled away, and the defendant came into the apartment. On top of that, as I mentioned before, as soon as the defendant saw agents, he fled. At that point, the agents had probable cause to believe that the defendant had engaged in a narcotics transaction. That was only further confirmed when the defendant would not show his hands. For their protection, they ordered him to the ground and found the $7,000.
Ms. Marin, do we need to decide the issue of probable cause? Why shouldn't this simply be decided on the basis of reasonable suspicion and a Terry stop? They obviously had ample reason to talk to the defendant. He flees, and as earlier questions have suggested, the steps to make sure that he's safe, he's not a threat to the officers, turn up the cash, and at that point they've got probable cause. Why is that an unreasonable view of the circumstances?
It's not an unreasonable view. It's our position that they had probable cause before they even discovered the $7,000 in the paper bag, but it's not.
What moment do you think they had probable cause?
At the moment that he fled from the officers. So in this case, you have not a series of combinations that this court has recognized has provided probable cause: suspicious vehicular activity, prior information concerning drug dealing, and flight from police. That being said, certainly by the time they discover the $7,000 in the bag, they have more than enough probable cause to permit the legal arrest. For those reasons and those stated in the brief, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm defendant's conviction and sentence.
Ms. Marin, do we have any indication in this record about when the officers said anything about putting him under arrest? I know we're dealing with a rather unusual posture of the record here.
I don't believe, Your Honor, that they Mirandized him. They certainly did handcuff him in the elevator, mm-hmm. but I don't believe that they Mirandized him until sometime later.
Well, that's a different question, though.
That's right. The most information that I have. They certainly did handcuff him and detain him after the time that he was in the elevator. But there was no testimony from the officers. The facts were stipulated. There's no testimony as to any officer saying to the defendant, you're under arrest,
okay,
to the best of my recollection. I'd have to go back and look at the reports.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Merritt. Mr. King.
The address, Judge Bauer, was 1617 East 50th Place.
I grew up at 70th and Woodlawn. So.
Did you? Okay. A couple points. To my recall of the record, A, there was not any verbal pronouncement of you're under arrest, and as this court well knows, that is, while a factor, that is not dispositive on the question. The question is, would a reasonable person in Mr. Blalock's position reasonably believe that they were restrained to a point of not being able to go and leave? And I have to say, under these facts, clearly that was the circumstance. I do believe it was an hour and a half after the fact, an hour and a half elapsed, while he's handcuffed on site before the arrival, per their investigation, of identified in the brief as Ms. Burt, for the execution of the consent. At some point after that point, as I recall the record, we have the Mirandization that Ms. Marin had referenced to. The various factors here, you know, there's $7,000 in change in money, $7,391. This court in the United States versus $506,231 in U.S. currency said the existence of a significant cash alone doesn't equal probable cause. And I'm not for a moment saying all they had was the proof of the $7,000. But even giving the government as attractive a Christmas tree strung with indicia, in this case, it does not amount to the right of government to make a physical seizure of the person of my client. It just didn't arise to that level. And a description of it, reiterating a point from earlier, trying to describe this as a Terry stop, I believe, is taking the intrusion that's permissible without running afoul of the Fourth Amendment to a new high or low, depending on one's perspective in analyzing this. I just don't think government, law enforcement, even where we as a society want to assure as best we can, in a very dangerous profession, as much safety as we can for law enforcement, we still have a greater right of the personal privacy rights, expectation of privacy of the individual. And under these facts, I respectfully submit the motion to suppress should have been granted. And all of the evidence that was seized, clearly, in an unattenuated line, springs back to that initial, what we contend was an illegal arrest. And therefore, we ask that this case be reversed, remanded, with instructions to grant the motion to suppress and for such other proceedings as are appropriate. Thank you to all of you.
Mr. King, and by the way, you were privately retained, is that correct?
I was.
After the suppression hearing,
after
right?
After the suppression hearing.
Right. Very good. Thank you to both.